And so when I think of an individual who's eating way too many animal products, of course, I would love for them to significantly cut back 90%, 95%, even 100%, especially eating animal products from factory farms versus a small percentage that are, let's say, high welfare or more sustainable. But truthfully, if someone cuts back 10%, 15%, if they participate in Meatless Monday every week, that to me is a huge win.
Green Hero. Hi, friends, and welcome to the Green Hero Podcast. This is Ricard, founder of Green Hero, your go-to source for making plant-based eating easy and enjoyable. Each week, we'll be digging into the inspiring journeys of people who live a plant-based lifestyle to tease out the most effective and fun ways to add more plants into your life.
Green Hero.
Today's guest is Brian Kateman, co-founder and president of the Reducitarian Foundation, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to reducing societal consumption of animal products. Brian is also the inventor of the term reducitarian, which means that you kind of reduce the amount of animal products that you eat. He's also the author of Meet Me Halfway and also the lead producer of the documentary version of Meet Me Halfway, which has been released and streamed on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, and Google Play. He's a regular contributor to Fast Company, Entrepreneur, and Forbes, and his writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Los Angeles Times, and The Washington Post, among others. Brian is someone who's really making a difference in bringing plant-based foods to the masses, and I'm really happy to finally get to speak with him. Brian, welcome and thank you for joining us on our podcast. I'm so excited to have you on our show. How are you doing and where are you calling in from?
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me. And I'm doing just fine. I'm in Summit, New Jersey, which is about 40 minutes outside of Manhattan. And I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, nice. Yeah, then we're pretty close to each other as I'm in Brooklyn.
That's right. Nice.
Yeah. So before jumping into our interview, I wanted to thank you for having me as a speaker at the Reducitarian Conference just a few months ago. I had an absolute blast there and I met so many cool people and many of them I've had as guests on this podcast as well. So thank you very much for that.
We're happy to have you there. It was a great time and really appreciate all the great work you do as well.
Yeah. So you're working on so many things. It's like the Reducitarian Foundation, the Reducitarian Conference. You've made the book Meet Me Halfway and the documentary for that. So you're actively making a difference in the plant-based space. But how did it start for you? How did you really get into this?
Yeah. You know, I think most origin stories start with our upbringing. So I'll take you to Staten Island, New York, where I'm from. If you know Staten Island, it's not known as a plant-based mecca by any stretch of the imagination. But one of the things it really does have going for it is it has a lot of nature. It's often considered to be a green, very green borough. And as a young kid, I kind of fell in love with the natural world. I really liked being in nature. And I also cared a lot about the animals that were living in the wild. And so by the time I got to college, I was kind of your typical environmentalist. I would tell people they should recycle, compost, walk instead of drive, so on. But it wasn't until later in college that I made the connection to food. I just happened to be given a book by a friend called The Ethics of What We Eat. I was actually eating a hamburger at the time on a plane traveling to present some undergraduate research on climate change. And I think my friend sort of handed it to me, maybe in jest, but also because he knew I was interested in philosophy. Mm-hmm. And that was really the first time I learned about factory farming, that we raise animals in these very intensive, cruel, unsustainable conditions. And that it's not good for really any of the inhabitants on the planet. And so I decided to be vegetarian. And for the most part, that worked out. But then there were these social situations where I found myself falling off the tofu train, as they say. One Thanksgiving, for example, my dad kind of cajoled me into having a piece of turkey to participate in the festivities of the holiday. And as soon as I popped it in my mouth, I remember my sister kind of poking fun at me. Mm. She said, "I thought you were a vegetarian, Brian." And I remember in that moment, not really having the words to articulate what I now believe to be true, but I remember the feeling, which is that I was kind of irked because I mm-hmm. wasn't like the average American, like my parents and my family who were eating well over 200 pounds of meat a year. I was trying to make a difference, even if I wasn't perfect. And so I had enough of those experiences where I realized that what I was after was this idea of trying to cut back. I really wanted to reduce animal product consumption to the best of my ability. And perhaps more nuanced than that, I recognized that the vast majority of people in my life, and quite frankly, in the world at large, were very unlikely to go vegetarian. And they were really even unlikely to significantly cut back on the amount of animal products that they consume. But they could be encouraged to cut back a small percentage. And if everyone participates, or a lot of people participate, and reduce their consumption of animal products, even by a small percentage in aggregate, that actually makes quite a big difference. It makes a bigger difference, arguably, than getting a small number of people to be 100% vegan or vegetarian. And so after looking up, some words like flexitarian and semi-vegetarian and mostly vegetarian that didn't really capture the spirit of what I was after, a friend and I decided to come up with this term called reducitarian. And a reducitarian is someone who's made a commitment to cut back on the amount of animal products that they consume, regardless of the degree of reduction or their motivation. And really, ever since the past 8 years or so, my team and I have been working very hard to spread this message and do our best to reduce consumption of meat, eggs, and dairy in order to end factory farming.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, because this is kind of things that I've discovered myself as well, like you can either go completely vegetarian or vegan, but when you kind of still eat maybe let's say some fish or some dairy or eggs, maybe even meat every now and again, like what do you think the response from the vegetarian and vegan community is about that? Like, do they understand, like to say like, hey, I'm actually very much plant-based, but I'm not completely plant-based. How does that vibe with like the way they think about things?
Yeah, I mean, there's no monolith in terms of this movement. There are many different kinds of vegans and vegetarians with their own different philosophies. There is certainly a small percentage who absolutely loathe the idea of creating a movement that's built around a sort of accepting that people are flawed and that they're probably not going to be vegan or vegetarian. And Reducitarian Foundation has received all sorts of emails and occasionally been protested and so on. But truthfully, that's a very small percentage of the vegans and vegetarians that are out there. I think the vast majority of vegans and vegetarians understand that it's not really reasonable to expect that the vast majority of people are going to go vegan or vegetarian, as much as they might like that. And they understand that if they're not going to go vegan or vegetarian, it's better that they cut back than do nothing at all. And also, the reality is that some people who do cut back decide to go vegetarian or vegan. Sometimes you just need to get started on the journey to make the path. And so there's mixed reactions for sure. But I would say, without a doubt, many of our biggest supporters and many of our attendees at our summit, the people who donate to us, so on, these are vegans and vegetarians who understand that using a more moderate message can actually build bridges, create inclusivity, grow the movement in a way that a more binary or polarizing kind of message might not. And so I'm very sympathetic to veganism, to vegetarians. I think if I could snap my fingers and make the world vegan, if there was no other choice, those between a vegan world and the world today, that would definitely be better on average. But that's not the reality that we live in. And I think it's important that we try to do the best we can, given the constraints that are imposed on us by the world around us.
Yeah. And the people who are thinking about more reducing their impact, like what do you feel that they would have to seen to wanting to do that? Like, what is the kind of moment when they're like, I want to do this?
It's a really great question. Everyone is going to have a different entry point into the reducitarian movement. For some people, they're going to first of all care about one particular motivation. So it could be the environment or animals or human health or worker rights and so on. And so sometimes I speak to my friends and my colleagues and, I'm going on and on about climate change or let's say about animal issues. And it turns out like, oh, the moment I mentioned that workers are not treated well in slaughterhouses, that actually really piqued their interest in the space. So it's important to recognize that different motivations are going to resonate with different people. There's also a major barrier with respect to how people perceive vegan food. If you can present a vegan meal to someone and it actually tastes good, that can actually lower some of the barriers that, because people have this objection that vegan food sucks. And if they think that, it's going to be really hard, regardless of some of these ethical, philosophical motivations, to make a change. I'll tell you, for me, one of the challenges that I have experienced is feeling as though I'm not perfect, feeling as though I can't do something, I can't be a part of something because I'm not capable or I'm flawed or whatever language you want to use to be 100%. And I see this a lot in people, and I see it across all kinds of different movements, whether it's mindfulness and meditation or exercise. And the moment you tell, in my experience, the moment you tell someone like that, that they have to be 100% about it, it really prevents them from engaging at all. And so that's something else I find that can be quite liberating for people, is just reframing, contextualizing the space and allowing them to understand that they can have ham on Christmas. They can mm-hmm. have turkey on Thanksgiving. They can eat way too much cheese, but they also can significantly cut back on chicken and on beef and on fish and on eggs and so on. And if they increase the amount of plant-based meals and foods and beverages that they're having, that's going to make a major difference. So yeah, someone might watch a film. They might read a book. They might come across a video about the horrors of factory farming. There's all these different kinds of messaging. And there's so many different people out there that I don't want to present the idea that we should be pushing one, but we should be pushing all of them to some extent. And hopefully it'll change the hearts and minds of as many people as possible.
Yeah, no, I agree with that too. And I think that I see more communities depending on like kind of what people want to engage with. If you engage with a vegan community, you know, that's for you. If you want to reduce your meat consumption, that kind of what resonate with you, and that's the community that you want to be part of. What I'm curious about is that, what are you saying as like the Reducetarian Foundation then? Like, how much plant-based food do you think somebody should eat, and how much vegetarian? Like, to make really an impact, do you think like people should be 25% or 50% plant-based? Like, what is it that you're trying to get people to do? You know, more on a kind of a metric.
Yeah, you might not like this response, which is valid, so we'll work it out together. But here's the thing, right? So I think of the average person eating over 200 pounds of meat a year, and I think of the world at large, and I don't like many parts of the state that we're living in the world, right? All the problems that we're facing. And my question that I ask every day is, how can I make the world marginally better? Or how can I prevent it from getting worse? And so when I think of an individual who's eating way too many animal products, of course, I would love for them to significantly cut back 90%, 95%, even 100%, especially eating animal products from factory farms versus a small percentage that are, let's say, high welfare or more sustainable. But truthfully, if someone cuts back 10%, 15%, if they participate in Meatless Monday every week, that to me is a huge win, because it's so damn hard to get people to change. And this is a lousy reality. This is a really difficult thing to do. It is really hard to get people to cut back on animal products. And so having unrealistic expectations, I think, is not a good strategy. So yes, we can talk about ideals all day long, right? 75%, 50%, 90%. And it's fun to throw out numbers about what my preference is. Mm-hmm. And we can debate and think about our ideal vision for what the food system looks like. Is it 100% vegan? Will it have some animals who are living on high welfare, sustainable, even regenerative farms? How much should people be eating plant-based meat, like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods? What about cell cultured meat? Are we fine with people eating 200 pounds of meat a year if it's not derived directly from animals, but instead from cells? And all of these are really interesting questions. But to me, they belong in a undergraduate philosophy classroom. They don't belong in necessarily in the practitioner world. So yeah, I want people to cut back as much as possible, but I'd be very happy if someone cuts back a little, and maybe that will result in them cutting back a moderate amount or a lot. But I start with where we're at. Anything that is better than where we're at is worthy of celebration, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think I'm more coming from the perspective of just endless choice. If we're just giving people to say, like, you can do whatever you want, it's really hard to know what you're going for. Like saying, like, the vegetarian movement is very easy. You're like, I'll cut out this, then I'm vegetarian, you know? And I'll cut out all animal products, then I'm vegan.
Right.
And so I think it's more has to do, my question is more with like, how do we get people to identify with something? Like, if I want to identify as, let's say, a Reducetarian, I know that that means like half of my food is 50% plant-based, for example. And you kind of identify with us and you can say like, I'm a reducetarian. And people say like, what does that mean? And you're right. Like, 50% plant-based, you know? It's like right. A very simple answer.
Yeah.
So I think it has to do more about that it's a question I'm very interested in. It's like, how can we get people on board on stuff? And I think that's what the vegan movement does very well, even though that becoming vegan is really hard and kind of a extreme position, as you say, from like a social perspective, for example. But then again, it's a simple message.
Yeah, it's a fair question. For what it's worth, The Reducetarian Solution was our first book that we put out. And the number we chose was 10%. So if I had to be pinned to a number, I would choose something very small because it's doable for people. Very few people are going to cut back 50% or 100%, at least to start. Mm-hmm. It's too intimidating for the average person, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the idea is educating people on this broad idea that we eat too much meat. Because of that, we factory farm animals. Eating too much meat is bad for those animals, bad for the planet, and bad for our health. To the extent that you can cut back, that's a good thing. Any effort you make qualifies you as a reducetarian. And part of the concept with reducetarian is this idea of identity. That we don't have words to describe who we are, can be difficult for us to communicate, and also can prevent us from being consistent with respect to our behaviors. And so I like the word reducetarian because I think it allows people to say, hey, I'm a reducetarian. I'm trying to cut back on the amount of animal products that I consume. And when they're eating a meal and they see that it's beef or chicken or fish, they know that that's not necessarily aligning with what they're trying to do. And so, but for us, if I had to pick a percentage, I would say 10%. So if you're trying to cut back 10% on the amount of animal products that you consume, at least, then you're a reducetarian. And nothing would make me happier than someone who's eating 200 pounds of meat a year. Instead, they're eating 180 pounds of meat a year. That would be a huge, huge improvement because, as you know, and I'm sure many of your listeners know, we are headed in the opposite direction. We are seeing increases in the amount of consumption of meat in the United States and in many parts of the world. So 10% would be a huge victory.
Yeah. I'm also curious now when we're talking about numbers as well. You know, I'm from Sweden originally, so I have kind of a foot in Europe as well. And following the news in the UK, you know, the UK launched a new food strategy last August. It was published and they announced there that they are saying that the UK have to reduce their meat consumption with 30% within the coming 10 years for the UK to meet their sustainability goals. So with this food strategy, they are now trying to find more tactical ways of like, how is this going to happen, right?
Mm.
So I think what I would like to talk about is like, in Europe and especially Northern Europe, I would say Scandinavian countries, UK, Ireland, Germany, are very much in the forefront of the kind of plant-based movement. And it has a lot to do with climate change. Even people like my parents who are in their 70s are saying like, hey, we need to cut back on how much meat we eat. And I asked them like, why? They were like, well, they say so on the TV, you know?
Wow.
And I'm very curious because being here in the US, you know, the climate change conversation is just like, is it even real or not? You know, that's like one conversation here. And it's not really talked about much in the media. I think last summer when we had a big hurricane here in New York, a watchdog organization talked about that out of 700 news segments that was published for 3 days, only 2% or 3% mentioned the word climate change. So it's just something that's not in people's head. While here in the US, it's so many products coming out, much more products than it is in Europe. While the kind of, I think in this long-winded way of asking, what do you think of like how important the public conversation is for people to also become more aware? Because awareness is like a big factor as well, right?
For sure. I mean, there's really, you know, there's two components to this. There's the public, and as you said, their awareness and understanding of the issues, and that's certainly going to be a factor. And then there's a much smaller percentage of decision makers and influencers that certainly have a tremendous amount of power. So you can think of businesses, for example, if they change up what they're offering in their cafeteria, you know, regardless of what the public is thinking, that's going to have a major impact on the choices that people are making. We know that public awareness is important. We also know that people don't primarily choose food based on ethics or environmental issues or even their own health. The vast majority of people choose food based on taste, on price, and convenience, and to some extent, social norms, what other people are eating around them. So it's this strange thing where we want the public to be educated and put pressure on governments and businesses and so on to make decisions that are in the interest of our planet. And we also have to understand that we should be somewhat skeptical of the public. And it's going to be up to decision makers to step up and create policies that are going to advance what is in the interest of the broader public, even if a percentage of them aren't on board. And that's a really tricky, really tricky thing to do. You know, if you created a meat tax, for example, in the United States, I could see there being riots in the streets. I think it would be madness because people don't want that. I could be wrong, but, you know, I've seen in New York, there was a time when the mayor was trying to get rid of large sodas, for example.
Yeah.
And that people did not respond well to that. So it's, you have to think, if the public was on board with climate change and with the hurting of animals and issues around heart disease and so on, they might be more amenable to that. So where I come from when I'm asked questions like this is a place of humility. I don't really know what's going to end factory farming. I don't really know what's going to significantly reduce consumption of animal products. And truthfully, I don't think anyone knows. I think we're at a relatively early point in our movement where we have to deploy a diversity of strategies and tactics to try to figure out, you know, what is the most promising way to actually go about doing this. And that's hard because we have limited funding and limited time and resources. And of course, every region, as you've implied, is going to be different. And so we have to adapt those strategies accordingly. But we have to try some percentage of all of those strategies until we have a better sense of what is actually going to move the needle. But certainly public awareness is a part of that. And also just trying to influence individuals, individual companies, so on, who have an outsized amount of responsibility because of the level of power that they have to help mitigate some of these environmental issues and others.
Mm-hmm. No, 100% agree. One thing that's, I think, also is interesting is, like, we talk a lot about the reasons of reducing our meat consumption, for example, or animal products in general. And we talk about the environment, we talk about health, et cetera, et cetera. But it was funny, I was speaking to this Swedish plant-based chef the other day, and she was saying that how she got into this, she was like, well, there was just so much more variety. She was like, I just had so many more options, like cooking plant-based food. And I was wondering if that is also like a tactic that could be used of just starting to talk about, like, hey, you have way more variety. You'll just eat so much more tastier food eating this kind of way, you know?
Sure. Again, you know, I think there's probably a certain percentage of people who that would resonate with. But I think there's actually a larger percentage when you use the word variety. You know, last night I got a vegetable fried rice at a Japanese restaurant. And I had asked the waitress what she thought was better, the vegetable fried rice or the teriyaki tofu. And she said, are you vegetarian? And I said, no, but I'm really trying to cut back on the amount of animal products that I consume. And she said, oh, well, I don't really like vegetables. So I honestly would probably recommend something else. And I said, okay. So again, like, variety, yes, can be good. But for a lot of people who don't grow up eating a lot of fruits and vegetables and whole grains or whatnot, you know, they're happy to continue to eat the 8 foods that they grew up eating, whether that's, you know, bacon and steak and chicken nuggets and burgers and so on. So, but you know what? You're right. The place I see this happening is with chefs. It's really cool to see restaurant owners and culinary experts be excited about this new landscape where we can elevate plant-based dishes in ways that has not been done before. And I think that can be very helpful in changing public perception, because when you go to a fancy restaurant and they have all these delicious plant-based options available and they're celebrated and elevated and so on, I think that repositions people thinking that broccoli is disgusting to thinking that it actually can taste really good and is kind of trendy and cool in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's for sure. That's for sure. So what's next for the Reducitarian Foundation and the Reducitarian movement as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the Reducitarian Foundation, we're really excited about our next conference that we're just announced that's going to be in Denver, October 27th to the 29th, 2023. And one of the things that I think is important that we start to do is move a little bit away from the coasts. We've had a lot of activities and events, you know, in terms of Reducitarian Foundation, also a movement in places like New York and San Francisco and LA, but there's a whole in between. And I'm pretty committed to steering some of our events and work to be centered in other parts of the country because I think they're fairly neglected. We have a new fellowship program, which I'm very excited about. Essentially, we recognize that we need a variety of tactics and strategies from many different backgrounds, many different places. And we want to play a role in recruiting young people to contribute to this movement. And so we're piloting this fellowship beginning in New York, but hopefully we'll expand it elsewhere, working with students over the course of the year and providing them with mentorship and internships and so on. And the hope is that these students will wind up making major contributions to the movement, whether they join existing nonprofits or companies or become entrepreneurs and start their own enterprises. We've explored the idea, and we're beginning to think more about this, of creating a new documentary, a new book, because we really love doing media campaigns. So that's something we're beginning to think about now that our previous campaign, Meet Me Halfway, has wrapped up. And in terms of a movement, you know, I think we see a lot of different promising strategies on the horizon. We're all excited about food technology in terms of plant-based meat and cell-cultured meat. And we need to continue to push those and hope that we see significant developments in lowering the price, improving the taste and texture, making it commercially viable, particularly in the context of cell-cultured meat. We need to continue to put pressure on corporations, you know, getting chickens out of cages and really create demands around high welfare, more sustainable practices in the meat industry. We need to be mindful of the fact that low-income countries, as they go through what's called a demographic transition, where they increase their wealth, they're going to be creating more demand for meat. You're going to see more factory farm companies bring factory farms to those regions. So perhaps we need to take more proactive measures before those factory farms are cemented as part of the culture to try to slow that down. And I could go on and on. There's so many great organizations, companies, individuals. You know, there's really thousands of activists in one form or another across the world that are doing their part to try to end factory farming and reduce societal consumption of animal products.
Yeah, that's awesome. And is there any organization or brand that impresses you at the moment that you think people should check out?
Yeah, it's hard to call upon one. You know, I think of these different categories. I think of the food tech space. I think of the Good Food Institute and Plant-Based Foods Association and New Harvest. I think of the great work that Mercy for Animals and Friends of the Earth and others are doing to try to change corporate policies. I think of all the great companies like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods and Upside Foods. I think of all of the professors and all of the teachers that are educating youth on the issues with factory farming. So I could list out, you know, truly hundreds, if not thousands, of organizations that are focused on one particular motivation or one particular kind of animal or one particular kind of strategy. But here's what I'd say. If there's anybody listening that wants to get involved in the movement, there is a place for you. Whether you want to become an investor or you want to become a philanthropist or you want to become a chef or you want to open a school, or there's so many, you want to put pressure on corporations. There's so many ways to get involved. And we actually just created a new page on our website about how to get involved that kind of lists all the different strategies and tools and gives a sample of some of the organization and companies that are doing this great work.
Awesome. And what's the URL if people want to check that out?
Probably reducitarian.org/how-to-get-involved. But it's right on our website. You can't miss it. If you go to reducitarian.org, right at the top navigation bar, you will see that page and you'll see our Reducitarian Summit and our Meet Me Halfway documentary and book. And there's plenty of resources. We have a podcast, much like yours, where we educate people on different ways that they can contribute to this movement. So it's really going to take all of us from different walks of life, different backgrounds to contribute. And I really hope that if we pool our resources and energies and passions, that we will be successful in ending factory farming.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, Brian. And I hope to talk to you soon and keep up with what Reducetarian is doing.
Likewise. Thank you very much for your work and for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
That was our episode for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. The Green Hero podcast was produced by Andrew Rojek, and I'm your host, Rickard Bjerkdal. I'll see you next week for another conversation from our colorful plant-based world. And of course, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast or share this episode with a friend. If you haven't already, you can also find Green Hero in the App Store. Download our app and start enjoying a plant-based lifestyle today. You can also find us on the web at the URL greenhero.life and on Twitter and Instagram, where we operate under the handle Green Hero Life. All right, see you next week. Bye-bye.